Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A reminder that we Zoom on Monday afternoon, so if something should happen Monday night, we'll be discussing it at the end of the week. As you come to expect every single day since March, we have begun our show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Hinman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. It was about speaking truth to power. It was about someone who understood what patriotism meant. And it was someone who assured his father that he did the right thing when he moved to the United States. Well, when he said that, in my gut, I kind of knew it wasn't the right thing. And now the rest of the world knows it wasn't the right thing either, because until we remove this president, not much will be stable and secure. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Hinman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
I have had the pleasure of hanging out with my next guest for years. And I met him because a guy that I was dating at the time wanted to buy a railroad car. And Steve Pakin's father was in the business of selling these kinds of cars. I still can't believe this. And that was a guy that was how many years ago. And when I met your dad, he kept saying to me, Steve Pakin, you got to meet my son. You got to meet my son. And that was the best gift he ever gave me, was that he allowed me to meet his son. Steve Pakin is the host of a show on TV Ontario, known as The Agenda. And I was trying to explain The Agenda to someone the other day, Steve Pakin, and I decided it's kind of a blend of the following. It's a blend of NewsHour on PBS, the BBC's Hard Talk, and Trevor Noah's The Daily Show. And you kind of thread those three together. And I think, Steve, that's what you've accomplished. And it's an incredibly well-watched show. So well-watched, everyone. I swear to God. I remember landing in Toronto and getting picked up by a taxi cab driver. And the next thing you know, we were talking about your show the night before with a taxi cab driver. So, you know, it is much-watched TV in Toronto. So let me welcome Steve to the program. How are you?
I'm just great, and even better for having heard all those wonderful stories. That's terrific. And I should let your listeners know, of course, that they can watch it as well. The show's on YouTube. YouTube.com/theagenda, YouTube.com/theagenda. And all of the interviews that we do are there, including ones that you have been on in years past. So it's all there.
Yeah. So I went to YouTube, I went to TVO, and just the other day you had a show that was entitled U.S. Political Chaos in Canada. Mm-hmm. And as I was thinking about sort of reaching out to you, I kept thinking about the fact that, you know, you're our biggest trading partner, our longest border. And I saw an article, I think it was at CNN, and it was talking about the fact that, you know, Donald Trump talks about the fact that Mexico is going to build the wall on the southern tier. And what COVID has done, COVID has built the wall between the United States and Canada, because the border has been shut down since March. It probably won't be opening until October, if even then. And I am looking at not only this relationship that has been so intimate for so many years, but between this president, the political chaos, what's going on with COVID, and even now on the West Coast with climate change, I feel like this relationship has been strained. And I'm wondering, as you sit from, you know, your vantage point on the other side of the border, what do Canadians think of the insanity that we're living?
Well, it's, of course, more than COVID. The downturn in the relationship between Canada and the United States actually happened when your president decided unilaterally that Canada was, quote unquote, a national security threat to the United States and therefore put big tariffs, import duties on our steel and aluminum. And I have to tell you, Arnie, that was, I mean, our countries have had, with the exception of the War of 1812, our countries have had pretty decent relations for more than 200 years. Of course, we've disagreed on some things along the way, but we've always managed to resolve them without, you know, without ruining the relationship too much. But I have to tell you, I think a lot of Canadians were just absolutely taken aback. Never mind. I mean, we've had issues over softwood lumber. We've had issues over steel. We've had issues over the World Series coming north of the border for the first time ever in 1992. There have been irritants in the past. But to have your closest ally, and that's what we think of you as, and we hope you think of us that way, to have them refer to us as a national security threat really made Canadians look at not Americans, but at this president and your government differently. And it has flowed from there. Now with COVID here, of course, a lot of, you know, thousands upon thousands of snowbirds who like to go south for the winter. It looks like that may not happen this year. We have, obviously, I think 80% of the Canadian population lives within a two-hour drive of the Canadian-American border. And as a result, there had been tremendous traffic back and forth. None of that is happening right now. Americans are not coming north to Toronto to see theater. Canadians are not going south, for example, to Buffalo, New York, to see the Buffalo Bills play or the Buffalo Sabres. There's all this two-way relationship that just isn't happening. And it's sad. It's really sad. And some of it's COVID, but some of it goes beyond that, I'm afraid.
Well, you know, I mean, Donald Trump has this thing about, you know, America first, America first. He doesn't even know what that means, Steve, because if it was America first, we would actually, you know, we in sort of how do I massage our relationship with Canada because of that longstanding relationship we've had forever. And it would actually enhance who we are. But Donald Trump has no sense of policy. He has no sense of relationship. He knows how to be vindictive. He knows about vendettas. He thinks somehow that he's appealing to his base. And in fact, I'm finding more and more people who are so offended by these tariffs and what it means for them in the way of construction. But I'll be honest with you, we're all yearning to be in Canada because we can't even comprehend the chaos we are living in right now. And I know that you are seeing a spike in COVID, as many countries are right now, but we have never stopped our spike. We are living in a place where I described the president the other day as really an accomplice to the pandemic. He is not a president. He is an accomplice. And when you have the leader of the country that's supposed to keep you safe and secure, basically aiding and abetting sickness and death, I'm just going to advise you, stay on your side. We're all jealous of what's happening on your side, because not only do we have to get through the politics of November, but we have to then pick up the pieces, assuming we get a change with what he has done to devastate us both economically. We are sicker, we are poorer, we are weaker.
Let me respond to that, Arnie, by making a comparison here. I suspect many of your listeners remember a guy by the name of Rob Ford. He was the mayor of Toronto, and he was a real, like, he was a populist who wanted to come into the mayor's office at City Hall and just really tear everything down. Anyway, he had a different way of doing things. He ended up on the U.S. talk show circuit. He became very famous, sometimes for the wrong reasons, and then tragically actually contracted cancer and died very young. I raise his name now because his brother, Doug Ford, is the premier of the province of Ontario, 14 and a half million people. And he used to be a tremendous admirer of your president's. You know, he identified himself as a Republican, even though we don't really have the Republican Party in Canada. We have the Conservative Party in Canada, but he admired Republicans. He admired conservatives. He admired President Trump. And he won the premiership of the province of Ontario in June of 2018, promising essentially to bring a kind of a populist revolution to the province of Ontario. And then COVID hit. And you never saw a guy do a 180 faster than Doug Ford. Instead of now, they used to say about Doug Ford, he's the bull who brings his own china shop with him. That's how much he wanted to disrupt existing institutions and sort of go against the grain and take on the establishment. And, you know, it's just filled with populist fervor. Once the pandemic hit, and once Donald Trump started doing as you've described it, you have seen the most remarkable transformation in Premier Doug Ford. Instead, he's not saying anything admiring about Donald Trump anymore. And in fact, he says, Americans, we love you. you know, when the time is right, we want you to come back and visit. But right now, based on what I'm seeing of how you folks are handling the pandemic, sorry, we don't want you here. We got our own problems. Now, that would have been unimaginable for Doug Ford to have said a year ago. But that's what he said since the pandemic hit. He's very disappointed in Donald Trump. He says it numerous times that he has a daily briefing, you know, like Governor Cuomo would and many of the other leaders and governors. He has a daily 1 p.m. briefing on live television for all to see. And on numerous occasions, you know, he has expressed his disappointment with Donald Trump. For example, you know, Windsor and Detroit have a great deal of, you know, there's a lot of crossing the border there.
Oh, and God, yes.
We were at the point where, I mean, I think there's $1 billion in commerce before COVID that went across the Ambassador Bridge every day. Mm-hmm. Okay, so COVID hits and we're still sending nurses from the province of Ontario to jobs in Detroit and Michigan in order to help people deal with the healthcare crisis there. But for some reason, Donald Trump decided that he was going to close that border to personal protective equipment coming from Michigan into Ontario at a time when we particularly needed it the most. And Doug Ford, who had always been an admirer of Donald Trump, said, "What kind of friend does this? What kind of friend denies us what we need and abrogates contracts that have been signed, you know, in a moment when we need it the most?" And I think that just completely changed his views on Donald Trump. And it also made Premier Ford say, never again is the province of Ontario going to be held hostage to the whims of politics in other countries when it comes to the health of our people. And he has signed, I think, in the interim, tens of millions of dollars worth of agreements with, you know, 3M, for example, and others to manufacture PPE in the province of Ontario, because he doesn't want to be, you know, beholden to Trump and others in the United States. So that's some of what's been going on over the last 6 months here.
That's an incredibly powerful story, but I've got to sort of ask more about him. Did he have a history of politics? Did he have a history of policy? Did he have you talked about his brother who died. So obviously it's in the DNA of the family that they're politically engaged. That's part of the problem with Donald Trump. Donald Trump had none of that. Donald Trump was a master manipulator. Donald Trump was, you know, he was someone who loves to blow things up, who loves to create, you know, both chaos. I mean, we saw this a wonderful, wonderful PBS show called The Choice. And it was, you know, Trump versus Biden. And the one thing that I need to have Canadians hear from my voice is that the one word that came over and over again in The Choice was the word that his father used on him when he was a little boy, that Donald Trump, you need to understand, you are a killer. You are a killer. That was what Fred Trump told his young son. Understand, that is not someone who's being prepared to lead in a democracy. That is not someone who cares about the safety and security of other people. That is someone who knows how to massage and play to his ego, but he does not know how to lead a country. And I am trying to figure out how you look at what we are doing, because I am terrified that we are not going to have closure with this election. And Donald Trump doesn't want closure. And the Republican Party doesn't want closure. He wants to win at any cost. And if he wins at any cost, there will be chaos in this country. And trust me, that chaos will not stop at the border.
No, I know. And we did a show about this actually on The Agenda just last week. And, you know, had we done this show 6 months ago, I think people would have said, oh, this is yellow journalism and you guys are just, you know, you're reaching here. You're reaching. This is not a story. You're doing this crazy topic for ratings. But the show was a second civil war is coming to the United States. Discuss. And of course, we had some, you know, fairly establishment foreign policy types on who said, look, things are crazy right now, but they're not going to have a second civil war. That's just, you know, the center will hold and the institutions will hold. And you know, people are just fear mongering whoever says this. But there's an author, and he's actually very well published. He's written for the New York Times. He's written for Esquire, a number of publications in Canada, GQ, some well-known American publications as well. And it was his position, and he's been working on a book for I guess the last couple of years, saying that the second American Civil War is coming. And every time somebody says to him, "Oh, that could never happen," whatever it is, you know, like for example, a president declining to participate in the peaceful transference of power if he loses an election. You know, every now and then, there's another one of these institutional pillars that gets knocked down. And the author's name is Stephen Marsh, and he was saying to us on the air the other night, he's saying, every time I think, you know, that we've reached the end of the intolerable, there's another thing that comes. And of course, it's not going to be a civil war like the North and the South 150 years ago. It's going to be different. It's going to be, you know, Michigan militia types with armed to the teeth, taking on institutions, and you know, it's going to look different, but it's going to be violent, and it's going to, and this is his view, it's going to be violent, it's going to break out all over the place, regardless, he seems to think, of who wins the next election. Because if Biden wins, those who, you know, are the 42% that will follow Trump, even if he shoots somebody on the middle of Fifth Avenue, you know, they're not going to be very happy either. So I don't mind saying, I think there are lots of Canadians, we're a population of 36 million people here, you know, about a tenth the size of California. There are a lot of people north of your border who are quite scared when we look south and wonder just how much lower can this whole thing go.
Well, Steve, you know, I'm going to ask a question. I'm going to ask a question, Steve. And you know, the institutions will hold. Which institution has held?
Good question.
We keep saying the line, Steve. Okay. Show me what has held. I mean, I'm looking at Amy Coney Barrett. I'm looking at what's happening now with the Supreme Court. You know, it just shocks me, because every time I'm looking for an institution to hold, I'm looking at the court and that's not happening. I'm looking at the Senate and that's not happening. I'm looking at the executive branch and that's not happening. I'm looking over and over and over again where he's targeting states, he's targeting cities. I keep looking for an institution that holds. And what frightens me is I'm not sure where to find one. And that is what is so shocking. And I think you're absolutely right. Whether it is Biden or Trump, I think there will be chaos. The only difference here is that if Biden wins with an overwhelming majority. So I always say Biden has to win the polls. He has to win on Election Day, and he has to win after they count all the votes. I mean, it's got to be a trifecta. It can't just be one, because any angle that he can use, he will use effectively. And of course, what we already know is that while the Republicans were so shocked when he said there's not going to be, of course, there'll be a transfer of power. Of course, then start parsing their words. You know, because words have no meaning anymore with one side of the political aisle, because it's their actions that you have to look at. And their actions is they're hiring lawyers. Their actions is they're challenging the vote already. And you look at that and you hear the words and you look at their actions, and I see nothing that even resembles stability after the election.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most unfortunate developments actually in the history of democracy. And if I can also add, you know, of journalism as well. There is a lot of great journalism going on out there. There are reporters who are chasing down empirically provable facts and printing them or broadcasting them or putting them on the radio or however those facts are being transmitted. And there is simply a sizable chunk of the population right now. It's very big in the United States. It's smaller in Canada, much smaller, thankfully. The attempts to create a Fox News North failed in Canada, interestingly enough. There was an attempt by a kind of a Rupert Murdoch type guy up here to create a Fox News North. The whole thing lasted for 2 years. He lost hundreds of millions of dollars and then shut the thing down, because there just is not, there is not a big, angry, mostly white, mostly male, exasperated constituency in Canada for that kind of talk, for that kind of thing. So it didn't work here. We have certainly plenty of it in talk radio, but an attempt to create a Fox News North on television failed here. But the thing that you know has just concerned me about the United States so much is that it almost doesn't matter who says what anymore. You know, the 42% are going to believe their president come hell or high water, and nothing he says is going to detract them from it. And there's almost nothing he can say to the other half of the population, you know, to make them think that he's got anything relevant to say to them either. You are in such cleavages in the United States right now, and nobody seems to care about facts anymore. And I just don't know how you get out of it. It's scary.
What I'm trying to figure out is what explains why Fox did not survive in Canada, but it survived here. And I have to ask, You have a safety net in Canada that we do not have. You have universal health care. You, when it comes to the affordability of school, when it comes to so many things, it is such a different environment. So that even if people are losing their jobs, or even if people are underemployed, the amount of struggle and the amount of insecurity pales in comparison to what we are living here. There is absolutely no question. After the 2008 economic meltdown, it was the wealthy that came roaring back. We're looking at the billionaires that are making money on COVID-19. I mean, the billionaires have seen their billions increase by 30% since March. Mm-hmm. Since March in the United States, as people are, you know, on food lines. But I'm kind of curious, how have you tackled COVID and how has it impacted your economy? You do have universal health care, unlike the United States. I am wondering if that gave you a better foundation upon which to build and also upon which to bring the community together to understand what they needed to do until a vaccine is available.
There's no question all of that is true, but I would make one more observation, which is wearing a mask in your country has become a political statement. And it just never has in Canada. It's fascinating, you know, even people who are conservatives, you know, who have a built-in distrust of the state or a built-in skepticism about the state and the amount of government in their lives, even they're wearing masks. And the whole thing about, you know, if you wear a mask, you know, you're a softie and only real men, you know, don't wear a mask. That whole debate never happened in Canada. The fact of the matter is our public officials, our politicians, conservatives, liberals, socialists, it didn't matter, separatists in Quebec, Green Party, everybody wore masks here. All the political leaders and the public officers of health, they modeled the kind of behavior that you would want a population to adhere to in order to flatten the curve and prevent this thing from getting out of hand. And we just never, and the funny thing is we had a very small group of anti-mask wearers who were demonstrating on the front lawn of the provincial legislature in Toronto. It's like our state house. They were demonstrating there weekend after weekend after weekend. And the fact of the matter is they would have represented part of the base of support that the current premier of Ontario, Doug Ford, enjoyed. And when Doug Ford saw that, the next day he went to the microphones, as he does every day for his daily briefing, and he called them a bunch of yahoos for refusing to wear masks. It was a sister soldier moment, if I can use that expression, Arnie. Right. It was him facing down the worst parts of his base and saying, look, I get that you don't like government telling you what to do, but we're in a global pandemic here and we got to flatten the curve or else. It's interesting. Go ahead, Ken.
Can I ask you a question? What you're saying is that Canadians have both their politicians and their rank and file citizens are remaining sane and reasonable. And they're not, no, I'm serious. The example you gave about that writer said the second civil war is coming to the U.S. I've been worried about that for a year. And every time I say it to somebody, I think, oh, Ken, you're out of your mind. You know, it's just crazy. That's not going to happen. And just like your country, you know, every day it seems more and more like this is really a realistic thing. And our people, there's a level of craziness, the 40% that are out there supporting Trump. Even your conservative politicians are remaining sane enough to say, hey, let's protect ourselves from this pandemic. Why are we nuts in this country?
Well, that you're going to have to figure out on your own. But I will tell you that the newly elected leader of the Conservative Party of Canada, who just won the leadership a few weeks ago, he's got COVID-19. He and his wife contracted COVID-19. So, you know, if you need any proof that anybody can get it, even conservatives. And he's not one of these guys who wants to flip the bird to the protocols. He's, you know, he believes in all of this. I think a lot of this, look, I'm going to simplify this down quite significantly here, but I think it does make a point. The most important words in your constitution are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's all about the individual. It's about the individual pursuing their self-actualization and often, you know, with unstated, but often with the view of, you know, too bad if it doesn't work out for everybody else, but I'm all about my own life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. The most important words in the Canadian Constitution are peace, order, and good government. Canadians for 150 plus years have just had a little more faith in the public spiritedness of our institutions and our public service. You don't hear a lot of people running around Canada talking about the deep state. And the fact is that a lot of these public servants who we like to, you know, crap on at 9 o'clock in the morning every day, have in fact been the backbone of the agenda to make sure Canada doesn't sink during COVID-19. And by that, I'm talking about, you know, people who work in the Ministry of Health, people who work in the Ministry of the Environment, nurses, doctors, teachers, personal service workers. Yeah. These are all people who earn a paycheck courtesy of the taxpayer. And I know in your country, for some people, they're called the deep state, but up here, they're considered the front line of attack against COVID-19. So I think there's just that big difference in how we view, you know, our respective countries.
The word I'm so jealous of is the word fraternité. I mean, that the idea that you can come together, that the community is so important. Someday, Steve, I want you to come back, and I want you to talk about Pierre Trudeau's Charter of Rights and Freedoms. I was really...
Trudeau, who died 20 years ago today, Arnie.
Yeah, oh, you're kidding. Oh,
yep, the current Prime Minister's father. Yep, the current Prime Minister is Justin Trudeau. His father brought in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms in the early 1980s, and he died 20 years ago today.
Well, I did not know that, but I want to talk about the Charter of Rights and Freedoms sometimes, because I want people to hear it. Because again, we can learn from each other. There is no question about it. You know, I live in a state that says, you know, it's live free or die. This is a state where the libertarians are like, you know, supreme. And yet in the end, I think what we're finding out from the pandemic, whether we like it or not, what we're going to find out from climate change is that, damn it, we need each other. We absolutely need each other. And if you think you can solve this on your own, you will die. The problem is not only will you die, but you will infect others. And I think it's going to really require another turnaround. I think Donald Trump is, to a large extent, I'm hoping, one of the last gasps, because the reality of living out his fairy tale is to see the spread of illness and death and economic deprivation. And that is something that no country wants. I don't know what happens when Joe Biden, if he does win. There's a lot of repairing to do. But I think the most important thing that we need to do is not only do we need to repair, but we need to move quickly. Something Democrats don't do, something Republicans have always done very effectively, and that is to sort of dismantle something. We need to repair and build something. Steve Paikin, it is always a joy and a pleasure to have you on the air. We have to do this again. Everyone, go to TVO.org and check out The Agenda with Steve Paikin. And as I said at the beginning, think of the NewsHour, BBC's Hard Talk, and Trevor Noah's The Daily Show, and you get Mr. Paikin. Thank you so much.
Arnie, it's always great to talk to you. Call anytime. I love talking Canadian-American politics with you. It's always good fun.
It's a joy. Ciao. Okay, everyone, stick around. We'll be right back. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
Just like the city that stagger on the coastline, and a nation that just can't stand much more. Like the forest buried beneath the highway, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter. Winter in America. Yes, and all of the hills have been killed, sent away. But the people know it's winter. Winter in America. And ain't nobody fighting, 'cause nobody knows what to say. Save your soul, Lord knows, from winter in America. The Constitution, a noble piece of paper, with free society, a struggle, but they died in vain. And now democracy is ragtime on the corner, hoping for some rain. It look like either hoping for some rain. see the robins perched in barren treetops. They're watching last-ditch races marching across the floor. But just like the peace signs that vanished in our dreams, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter. It's winter in America.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Again, a reminder that we are Zooming on Monday afternoon. We have chatted with Alex Shepard of The New Republic on a number of occasions, and I saw a piece that Alex wrote, and it reminded me of something that I had said about Governor Sununu, which is one of the reasons why I needed to grab Alex, because great minds think alike. The title of his piece was, Senate Republicans Have No Intention of Stopping Trump from stealing the election. Alex, you read Republicans and their words correctly. And for whatever reason, the mainstream media seems to glom on to whatever the word of the day is from the Republican Party, but they don't look at their actions. They don't look at their behavior. They take a word that could be interpreted in 25 different ways and interpret it in a way that sort of massages them and makes them feel better. But I think in reality, the Republican Party is basically doing everything that Donald Trump wants them to do, but they're not as harsh in their language, but I think they will be harsh in the result.
Yeah, I think last week when Donald Trump gave a very Donald Trumpy answer when asked if he would commit to a peaceful transition in power, I think what you saw was basically a dynamic that you've seen in the Beltway for the last 4 years, which is that, you know, the president says something that's outrageous, and I think also, you know, frankly, not probable, and Beltway reporters freak out about it, and then Senate Republicans sort of grudgingly condemn it, but not actually. So in this case, what you had happen was that they said, look, there's not going to be a military coup that's going to happen after the election, certainly not. And of course, nobody is really saying that that's a possibility. But they are leaving open for, and what, in fact, they're being very frank about, particularly when they're talking about appointing Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court, is the idea that they very much plan on challenging this election, both, you know, at the state level and probably, you know, 8 to 12 states, but also all the way up to the Supreme Court. That's Donald Trump's strategy. That's also the Republican Party strategy.
So what's wrong with the media? So when I read your article, I sent you a comment that I had written about Governor Sununu, because in a lot of ways, I almost feel like they send out the language you're supposed to use. Here's how you answer, okay? Use this word, use that word, whatever. And so I'm looking at my Republican governor, and my Republican governor was asked the question about what Donald Trump had said about the transition of power. And he said, Trump said, was very inappropriate. Okay, that was the word he used. And so everyone was like, see, he answered the question on me. And I'm like having a heart attack. And I said, really? What does the word inappropriate mean? All right. I said, so I actually went and I said, you know, inappropriate could mean unbecoming. Inappropriate, I mean, it has 1,000 meanings, but it doesn't really say that's something that a traitor says. That's something that violates the Constitution. This is not just about a norm. Nobody went that far. Everybody used these sort of glossy focus group words that sort of create the illusion of rebuke, but in reality, they were far from a rebuke. Why, Alex, does nobody push them?
Well, I think the first point I think is very interesting, and that is something that you see again and again, which is that Republicans essentially give the game away. They're saying two things at once here. They're condemning, and again, in quotation marks, the president for suggesting that, you know, he would, whatever, use the military to hold on to power. But they're also saying, look, we're upset that Trump said this because it's distracting from our real accomplishment, which is appointing a third Supreme Court justice in the first term of this presidency. These points are related, right? Amy Coney Barrett, they want her on the Supreme Court to rule in favor should a case make its way up to the Supreme Court. And no one was able to put those two things together. I think one reason why the media is very bad at this is that there's just this fetishization of sort of bipartisanism or bipartisanship, I guess. It's, say, ism because it's practically an ideology, but it's particularly true under Trump. There's this real desire to see Democrats and Republicans to somehow come together on behalf of, you know, the precious norms that bind us all together and rebuke, you know, this authoritarian, vulgar president. And that never happens. And yet the bar for acceptable bipartisanship is so low at this point that you get a situation like you had last week when, you know, dozens of Republicans are condemning the president, but interestingly enough, not naming him in any of their statements.
Yes, not naming him, exactly. Oh my God.
But it's because, you know, they're just so desperate. It's like, you know, it's West Wing brain or something. They're so desperate to see, you know, the people that govern come together and show how eminently reasonable that they are, that any but moment Alex, does this.
Yeah. But Alex, I hear what you're saying about their desperate. But in a lot of ways, they're sort of they're creating a lie. They're aiding and abetting an untruth. You and I both know we have not for the longest time we've seen even with Barack Obama that the idea of bipartisanship was dead. I mean, what did Mitch McConnell say? His whole raison d'être was to make sure that Obama was a one-term president. That was what he said when he got elected. I mean, this idea, this illusion of bipartisanship, you know, it's a nice fairy tale, but the reality isn't what it is. And I have a question. What the hell is the media covering? Are they covering an illusion of what they want to see, or are they covering the facts on the ground and the reality? And we need that reality now more than ever. And I can't believe at this moment, after Donald Trump has trashed every institution, has trashed every norm, has lied millions of times, that they are still somehow clinging to the idea of bipartisanship. And the only person who even creates the idea that there might be something that even smells like that is Mitt Romney, and he's kind of a joke. So, you know, I don't understand what it is that they are protecting when in reality they are not covering what is real.
Yeah, I mean, it's what they're covering is this sort of, you know, illusion of smoke and mirrors. They're covering the sort of, you know, the gossip of Capitol Hill. I think the other thing is that there's a real fear to actually come out and express what is actually happening. So they require other people to do it for them. So it creates this weird illusion of partisanship over what's actually true. I mean, it's obscene.
Well, you know, I told the story the other day, many, many years ago. So I've learned to look at the words and realize what the words don't mean when you're looking for a real meaning. You know, you want someone to complete the sentence. You want them to actually say what they believe as opposed to this fudge that they're handing you. And I told a story about, you know, running for governor and being before a group of environmentalists. And at the time, it was still in the primary. There were three Republicans. There were three Democrats. And the guy that ultimately became governor, Steve Merrill, most charming, most charismatic. I mean, this guy, you would fall in love with him in 37 seconds. And so the Q&A started. And at the end, they rated the six of us. I was rated number one, but very close to me in number one was Steve Merrill, who really almost tied for his response. And I am looking at the environmental community and I'm going, excuse me? You rated him what? So I had my staff do something really interesting. I transcribed his answers. Mm-hmm. All right? And then I sent the transcription over to the environmentalists who did the rating. And I said, read the words. You tell me how he was embracing your agenda. You show me where in what he said actually accomplished that. And I almost feel like that's what I want to do with Mitch McConnell. That's what I want to do with, you know, Lindsey Graham. That's what I want to do. And I want to hand it back to the media and say, you tell me what he said. You know, and I understand that maybe they have this beltway mentality. But when does the beltway mentality get beaten out of you when you begin to see over and over again that none of the norms are still in effect?
Well, one of the oddest things about the response was that there's this idea that, you know, the Republican Party or Republicans in the Senate in particular had somehow transcended partisanship by rebuking the president over these comments. But there's probably nothing more partisan than what the Republican Party is planning right now in how they're going to contest the election, right? They're telegraphing it weeks before. They've got lawyers everywhere. And again, it's not just the Trump campaign. Already, when you talk to Republican senators, you listen to what Republican senators say on, you know, Meet the Press and Face the Nation, what they're saying is we're taking this election to the Supreme Court. And that is what we have to get ready. We have to get ready for Bush v. Gore on steroids. And yet the idea that Trump has somehow crossed this red line, which again is a military coup, when in fact, you know, we're having this incredible ramping up of a legal response to an election. It's really absurd.
So, Alex, I'm going to put you on the spot. So the answer that Lindsey Graham keeps giving is the answer that this will be resolved in the Supreme Court. So that now says to me, I won't know what the roadmap is for this interview, this public interview with Amy Coney Barrett. How do you ask her a question regarding how she will decide on an election? Because, you know, I mean, is there a quid pro quo? But it's part of the conversation between Donald Trump and her. I mean, of course, he will never directly ask and she will never directly answer. But the fact that they've somehow assured that the Supreme Court is basically going to rubber stamp whatever Donald Trump wants the result to be, to me, is shocking. And I'm just trying to figure out, how the hell do you question her?
I think this is something I've been thinking about a lot. I tend to at least not think of myself as a particularly tinfoil-hatted person, but what we know about Donald Trump is that any person he appoints to a position of power, but particularly a position where they'll have some sort of control over his legal destiny, he always demands their loyalty, right? This was the James Comey issue. This is the Jeff Sessions issue. This is the William Barr question. And the idea that this question wasn't presented to Amy Coney Barrett, when, you know, the president doesn't leave things to subtext very often. I think it had been curiously subtle, with the exception of the president on the question of Obamacare. But on the question of the election, it's been very upfront. You know, I mean, Ted Cruz has been saying this. Lindsey Graham has been saying this. I think the idea that this was the one time that Donald Trump didn't ask someone for their loyalty, I don't necessarily buy that. But I do think that that's the kind of area that you have to go in. I mean, where Republicans are going to push back is they're going to say that this is conspiratorial. Of course, the president would never do such a thing. But I think that, you know, these are the questions that need to be raised here. I think Cory Booker and some others have said that they're going to ask that Coney Barrett recuse herself. That, I think, will kind of create some interesting tension, but she's never going to agree to that.
Well, you know, I mean, we know what Bill Barr did. Bill Barr wrote the memo that basically said, I'm yours. You know, whatever you want, Donald Trump, here's, I've already laid out the agenda and I am going to be your Roy Cohn. I mean, so we know he was very explicit. I'm not sure that she has done that. And on this area of election law, I'm trying to figure out, has she spoken about it? We know about her own choice. We know that, you know, the Federalist Society knows that she is guaranteed to, like, reverse Roe v. Wade. She's guaranteed to probably get rid of the Affordable Care Act. There's kind of this at least lengthy understanding that she has been sort of in print talking about this, or, I know, giving lectures about this. This, however, is a very sort of narrow area of the law that rarely, rarely comes up. And yet, at the same time, you're absolutely right. We saw Bush v. Gore, but there's going to be a million variations of Bush v. Gore. And how are you going to have to be so incredibly consistent in order to hand this election over to Donald Trump if he actually doesn't win?
Well, I think we should also note, too, that Amy Coney Barrett was part of the legal team that worked on Bush v. Gore, too,
for
the winning side.
So,
I mean, weirdly enough, you know, I mean, that could be one area in which Democrats target Coney Barrett. I mean, I think, you know, this is really a kind of smoke and mirrors play. And I think Democrats also they're showing, I think, a surprising amount of discipline, certainly more than they did during the Kavanaugh hearings, and keeping this focused on the Affordable Care Act. But I think that carving out space in these hearings to really target not just what Amy Coney Barrett believes, but where the Democrats think the legal questions the Trump campaign is going to raise, where those fall. I think that is what matters here.
So we're talking about, don't listen to what they say, watch what they do. And we're already seeing the challenges. We know voter suppression is in their DNA. But we cover Texas. And the other day we were talking about what's happening to Governor Abbott. And it turns out that there are Texas Republicans, including the chairman of the Texas Republican Party, and a number of other sort of high-ranking, I think the ag commissioner, they are suing Governor Abbott because he expanded early voting, not absentee balloting, not mail-in balloting, but he expanded early voting by a week because of COVID. And they are challenging him, saying that, you know, basically you overstepped your authority. This isn't just about the Republican Party. The Republican Party doesn't even, there's no consensus on what their message is. They want you to do mail-in voting, but they don't want you to count the mail-in votes. They want you to expand, you know, the voting early, and yet they don't want you. This is even chaos within their own Republican camp. What message are they sending to their base? I mean, I don't know about you, I'm confused. And if I'm a Republican, I wouldn't know what to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. We talk a lot about the like authoritarian handbook and how not Donald Trump is following it. But one thing you don't usually see incumbents do is to delegitimize an election before it happens. It's just not common, especially given that, you know, you just won the election. But I think they're already just seeding all of these narratives about fraud, right? But I think that the idea is just they're kind of wildly gesticulating here and just saying, look, we're just throwing out as many possible arguments that we can then use later on that this election is illegitimate, that they're going to basically try to retrofit what actually happens to these kind of wild, incoherent, often contradictory sort of cases that they're making about why early voting, mail-in ballots, et cetera, lead to fraud. There's no evidence of that. And yet I think what they're hoping to do is at least seed some of these ideas, even when you've got, you know, folks like FBI Director Chris Wray saying that, you know, voter fraud is not real.
So
isn't that their whole strategy, Alex? Isn't that their whole strategy? You can't analyze what they're saying as if they were speaking the truth. They're not speaking the truth. They know only one thing, and that is power. And they're exercising the power that they have. And their strategy is, we're going to keep exercising the power that we have. So in the election, if we can cut back Texas that extra week of early voting, then we'll cut that back. And if we can make some cuts here and make some cuts there, they're just throwing all the arguments on the wall and hope some of the mud sticks. And then later, they can say, well, we told you so. The arguments that actually may bear some relationship to some facts that occurred. But really, their whole agenda is not to tell the truth. So these media people who are analyzing, well, gee, the Republicans said this or that. How can they logically say no in 2016 to appointing a Supreme Court justice, but yes in 2020? It's not about rationality. It's about power.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true on the question of the Supreme Court vacancy. And I think in general, it's a real failure to understand or reckon with who Mitch McConnell is and what he represents, right? That he's somehow a guy who's just finding the right principle when in fact he is discarded with the concept of principle altogether.
Yeah.
On the question of fraud, I think it also serves their larger political message, right? This is a party that's largely abandoned policy making, right? The Affordable Care Act, which is the kind of raison d'etre of the last 10 years of conservative policy, is essentially a conservative policy. They have no healthcare plan. And yet what they've done, and I think Donald Trump has advanced this, it's one of his only political talents, is to make the case that they are the last line between, you know, decent Americans and barbarism, right? And this has been the Black Lives Matter backlash, but it also, I think, factors into some of the voting rights stuff, right? That the fraud argument has always been underselling it, but it's tinged with racism, this idea that there's ballot stuffing in, you know, inner city areas like Philadelphia and New York. And I think that one of the reasons why they're, you know, sort of allowing so many of these messages, even while many of them don't fit together, and in fact, many of them also probably discourage their own voters from voting, is that it's part of their larger message, which is that if you elect Democrats and your cities will burn and nothing will be safe, so you have to come with us. And yeah.
So Alex, this is an election of distraction. And I want to go back to an article that you wrote before the one we were just talking about, and that was from September 15th. And you wrote, "Why aren't voters blaming Donald Trump for the bad economy? Tens of millions are unemployed, hungry, and behind on rent." And then the second sentence is what made me want to vomit. "But the economy is barely registering as an election issue." How is that possible? How is that possible? I mean, I'm looking at all the stores that are shuttered. I'm looking at all the people that are unemployed or underemployed. I'm even looking at people that may be at work, but they're at work at home and they're Zooming and they got to educate their kids. And they're like looking at this going, oh my God, I may be making the same salary, but this life sucks. And I am just trying to figure out how it is possible that the economy isn't the first, second, third, and fourth issue, because the pandemic is the economy. And he is failing at the pandemic. He's failing at the economy. He's failing at opening schools. He's killing people. And yet, for whatever reason, we're not able to connect the dots. Are they that good at the distraction?
I think that they benefit enormously from sort of mainstream and corporate media that that gives them a lot to work with here. I think first you've got a long-standing narrative, which is that Republicans are better than Democrats at, you know, dealing with the economy, dealing with business. You know, certainly big fancy businessmen think this way, but if you look at any meaningful economic data going back a half century, you see a very clear picture, which is that the economy improves and, you know, the country becomes more equal, or at least less unequal than it does under Republicans. And yet, partly because we have a business media that is obsessed with the stock market and corporate right. bottom lines, and has no interest in any of the people, not just at the bottom, but in the bottom, you know, 95%. That I think is a huge issue here. This is not a media that's well equipped to cover issues like poverty and hunger, and we have a situation in which there is mass poverty and mass hunger. It's certainly been made worse by a pandemic for which we can, I guess, theoretically not blame Donald Trump for the existence of, but certainly if you look at the economic effects, there's a lot of blame to go around, not just the White House, but both Congress as well. But
I don't see how we fix it. And the reason I say that is this. So, for example, in most countries, big pharma can advertise their drugs. But in the United States, you can advertise your drugs. I mean, when you begin to look at who is writing the checks for basically all the media, you're realizing that they're going to want a certain result. And the certain result isn't going to be looking at the bottom 90%. It's going to be to aid and abet what's happening with the top 10%. And that has gotten worse and worse and worse. And it isn't just about money in politics, Alex. You know, it's what's feeding the TV cable beast. They're not going to challenge anything really effectively. They're not going to spend the time talking about it. Even when you look on MSNBC, how many people on MSNBC are former Republicans? Mm-hmm. How many people on MSNBC are people that basically used to cover Wall Street for Bloomberg? I mean, when you look, that's MSNBC. You know, and I'm trying to figure out really, and who's covering the labor beat? You know, who's doing the union shops? Nobody. And I think that's part of it too, is that we have a media that ultimately cultivates the kind of political results we're seeing, and the inability to ask the hard questions or to focus on what's happening to the 90%, because for some reason we're expendable.
There's another thing happening too, and I think this goes back to what we were talking about earlier as well, which is that the Beltway media in particular can only cover policy issues in through the lens of partisan disagreement. So on issues on which the Democrats are silent or are relatively silent, there's just not a lot of oxygen there for them to cover. So you see this issue where, you know, for most of the summer, the Biden campaign was going after, you know, the Lincoln Project folks and Republicans, people who are worried about, you know, Biden raising their taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And when that kind of thing happens, you saw this in 2016, I think, disastrously, when the Democrats sort of abandon the politics of class war, they tend to lose. Now, thankfully, over the last few weeks, and I think the release of, or sort of release of Trump's tax returns will help this, the Biden campaign has found a message that I think sort of solves all of these issues at once, which is this sort of Park Avenue versus Scranton message. That I think helps, but I think it doesn't. What doesn't help is when Democrats don't talk about these issues because they're trying to woo suburbanites and Republicans, and they tend not to get covered because the press, particularly in Washington, is just obsessed with, you know, a Republican said X, and so a Democrat said Y. And when both of the Democrat and the Republican are saying the same thing, or if the Democrat is silent, then these issues just don't get covered.
So we just finished talking to Steve Paikin from TVO Ontario in Canada, and he had did a show, and they were talking about the fact that they were looking at, is it possible that there will be a, quote, second civil war in the United States as a result of this inability to get closure or as a result of this election? So what's your thought, Alex, before I let you go? I mean, if you're going to have to start reading the tea leaves, I know that we have more weapons, you know, flowing around this country. You know, people don't buy guns. They buy an armory. Just kind of shocking. We're seeing, you know, these trucks with people with guns, you know, driving up and around New Hampshire, basically to threaten people and intimidate people. But, you know, Donald Trump likes to intimidate. He doesn't always follow through. My fear is that the militia types, they know how to follow through.
I think the biggest worry that, I mean, there are a lot of worries I have about what happens after the election, but I think the biggest is not necessarily a sort of second civil war thing, but just a sort of, we're already seeing an uptick in sort of political violence and conflict. And I think it's another thing the press is particularly bad at covering. Almost all this sort of violence is being, you know, instigated by right-wing folks who are then, you know, antagonizing various protesters. That's certainly a concern, but I think that, you know, one of the other worries I have is the way to fix this is a variety of political and judicial reforms, legislative reforms. And there are a lot of things that Joe Biden has really been reluctant to talk about. But I think what we need to do is just change partly the way that our political system operates to be able to have at least be able to turn down the heat every now and then. But I think if you get a situation certainly where, which is what I'm expecting, which is that Joe Biden is winning the popular vote by several million, but you've got, you know, close elections in several swing states. I mean, this is an election that could theoretically just not really ever end. And that situation, I think, gets very scary very quickly.
Alex Shepard, keep writing for the New Republic, and we'll keep calling you. It's going to be very, very interesting. And maybe you should do a course for the media. Maybe you should teach them how to sort of cover the news as opposed to sort of cover what they wish to hear. And I don't want to wish to hear. I want to hear. You know, I want someone to parse the words. I want someone to sort of force those politicians to complete the sentence and put a period at the end and explain their language. Because in the end, unless we force them to sort of live with their words, we end up with the kind of chaos and confusion that we're facing right now. Alex Shepard writes for the New Republic. We really appreciate your being here, and we'll call you again soon.
Great. It's great to be here.
All right. Thank you so much. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. This land is your land.